Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, we're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6. And we've got all of our regular Friday features coming up, Straight Out of Context, the Nick D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, and all of that, all coming up. And now I would like to welcome to the show a stand-up comedian who has been around for a while. I've always been a fan of his, and he has written a terrific book, one of the best books I've ever read about stand-up comedy, actually. The book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 80s Comedy Boom. And it is it's with great pleasure that I welcome to the show the author of that book and a very funny man, Rich Scheidner. Rich, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I've always been a fan. I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Oh, man, that's cool. Thank you. I'm honored.
I got to tell you, I just tore through your book. It's just so well written. It's really, the stories are amazing, and your journey is just great. When did you decide to write the book?
About two, 3 years ago. The guy who had dedicated it to Vic Anderson, I was kind of not doing anything really, and he said, "What you used to do?" He didn't know anything about my background really. And he advised me to do what I used to do for fun, just to do it for fun. So I started doing stand-up again, performing. Mm-hmm. And I said, I heard these stories I was telling him. He said, "Why don't you just write them and put them on Facebook?" And people started liking them, and then I started rewriting them. And then I said, well, maybe I got the book here. And I really wanted to make it about the history of the 80s comedy because really nobody had covered it or written anything about it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you did a great job. And I also love the book. Is that one of the things I really love the book, it seems like stream of consciousness, the way you wrote it. You know, the first part of the book does go kind of chronologically, and then you kind of just jump around all over the place, which I thought was great. I got to tell you, I love the cover, because on the cover, first of all, it's a great picture of you. But the thing I love about the cover is that it's all these ads for appearances that you were making at different comedy clubs. Your name is misspelled or spelled differently at least 15 times on the front of the book.
Yeah. That was the joke. I'm glad you got it. If you missed it. But I have like just tons of those ads. My mom had saved them, and I just was laughing at them. And I probably should have changed my name way back in the beginning. I just stuck with Scheidner, and I thought the real legal name is Schidner, and I changed the I to a Y thinking people could pronounce it. Nobody ever did. And then they just misspelled it in every ad. I think my favorite is the Yuck Yucks. Shy Diver. I don't know how they got Shy Diver.
That's the best one on that's the best one on the cover. It's in the lower left-hand corner, and it's hysterical. Yeah.
Yeah.
what was the other one?
When they had my name in the Cleveland Comedy Club with Shirley Heptel's picture. That I like that too.
So what was it about, you know, I mean, obviously I read the book, but I want people to hear your background. You know, you were always the guy that kind of made people laugh. And when did you decide, I'm going to try and do this? I'm going to try and do comedy.
I was in law school. I mean, it wasn't great law school. I mean, it was International School of Law and Screen Door Repair. And it eventually became George Mason University. But at the time, Howard Vine was a classmate. I was just making people laugh all the time. And he thought I was funny, and I thought I was funny, so we had to get a third opinion. He just took me to this coffee house in 1977. There were no comedy clubs that I knew of. There were none in D.C. for sure. There weren't, you know, there were scenes, like I said in the book, I wrote in the book, there were scenes in Chicago and San Francisco, had a scene in Boston, and then eventually we had one in D.C., but there were comedy showcase clubs, not paying clubs in New York and L.A., but I didn't know anything about any of that.
Yeah.
I don't think Howard and I even knew to call it stand-up. We just went and did what I'd seen George Carlin and Robert Klein and those guys do.
Yeah. And it is so, you know, there was nothing really happening in D.C. And there was no, like you said, there was no comedy clubs to speak of. Now, talk about El Brookman's Bar. That's where it all kind of started to happen for you.
Yeah. Like I said, I was in law school, and a friend of mine came up to me, and she showed me a classified. This is how old it was, 1977, no internet. Just shows me a classified in the newspaper, Washington Post. Said, if you want to do comedy, come to El Brookman's Bar. It was in Southeast. Why you got to go across the Anacostia Bridge? It was a little white country western bar in the middle of a black neighborhood, and it was bizarre. I mean, it's like, you know, all these places were small. It's like 80 people, you know, but people, immediately it became the place. Lewis Black showed up, myself, Kevin Rooney, T.P. Mulrooney, who moved out to Chicago to do comedy, and then John Heyman and Ron Zimmerman. All these people just showed up. A lot of them still in the business, still somehow in the business, whatever. And it became huge. I mean, like, it would be packed, just packed. People, the waitresses had to step over people sitting everywhere to do this because it was new. It was the people were like, stand up comedy, what are you guys doing? Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. And how long did you work there? That was kind of your home base.
Yeah, it was my home base for like, and I was like probably when it started like summer of 77 or, you know, and I got there when I came back in the fall. So I got there like in September of 77, and I was there till Garvin's opened in Washington, D.C., the first paying comedy club east of the Mississippi in 1979. So then I moved to New York City a few months after that. So, like, I was there till from 77, about a year and a half at Bell Brooklyn's to my head.
And when you moved to New York, what was the scene like in New York?
It was, nobody was making money. You know, there's Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Maher, Rick Overton, Gilbert Gottfried, you know, Richard Belzer was the king of Catch a Rising Star. And Kelly Rogers, but nobody was making any money. Everybody had straight jobs. Very, very few people were making any money. And then these little gigs started opening up, like these little one-nighters, you know, like little bar gigs outside of in New Jersey and for $50, you know, that sort of thing. And that was it. You know, you were just scrambling.
Yeah. You described some of the places that you lived in New York. Can you give us a little description? Your first place.
My buddy from high school was he tried out for the E Street Band, you know, Springsteen's band. He didn't make it, so he was burnt out. He was just tired of playing in bad bar bands, and he was a drummer. He wanted to move out, and I wanted to move up there, so we switched apartments. So I didn't even know it. It was not a legal apartment. It was in the basement of this building down in the East Village, and this again was New York City before it became hot again, and half the buildings were abandoned. It was just junkies everywhere. It was down in the East Village, and it was on 9th Street between C and D and Alphabet City, and it was not even a real apartment. It was like, I didn't realize it. You know, it was like these bad walls put up, and I was underneath it, and so I was below the sidewalk, and it had a window, and the bed was by the window, and he left me a gun. He left me a .22 caliber pistol. He's like, I should have known if that's part of, like, you need this. Like, I should have known. Like, you need this. Here, keep this. You take this. You need this. I won't need this anymore. And so I was sleeping by the window, which is right below the sidewalk, and there was this little well there, and it had the, you know, the gates, that locked the gates so people can't come in the window, and it was so hot in August, I just went, I gotta open these gates to try to get more air. And then I'm sleeping, and in the middle of the night, I feel something. I look down the bottom of my bed, this guy's crawling through the window across the bottom of my bed. So I just instinctively whipped the gun around, right? I had it by the bed, you know, I just whipped the gun around, I pointed at the guy, and he goes, hey, sorry, man, thought it was my place, and he backed right out. I guess that's how he ended. And then... Now the best thing was when my girlfriend at the time was living with me for a while before she went back to Italy, and she calls me a gig. I was Bill Maher remembered this better than I did. I was doing like a one nighter in Jersey, and I get a phone call. She called up, said she knew the bar I was in. We were working. There were rats in the apartment. She's screaming, rats, you're in the apartment. And so we finished the gig to get the $50. I'm going to come save her from the rats, but not before I get the $50.
Right.
And we drive back to the city, and I come into the place, and they're like literally like three or four rats sitting there, and it's just a one room place. It's not like one bedroom, right. It's just one room. Everything, you know, and so I go over, and I'm like, I've been drinking a little bit,
right.
And I grab the pistol, just start shooting the rats. Now she's screaming, and I'm shooting the pistol on the rats. So one of the neighbors upstairs heard screams, a woman scream, and some gunshots. So the rats eventually left. They went through a hole that they chewed their way through in the bathroom.
Right.
And I go to stuff her bag of cotton balls in there. And, of course, now I've gotten rid of the rats. We're firing up a celebratory bong, right? Now there's a pounding on the door. And it was one of those classics. Not pounding the door. What? It's the police. And I felt like somebody was goofing. So I'm like going, I did that classic, you'll never take me alive, copper, kind of just goofing, like playing around. And it's like, then there's a really insistent banging. Like, you know, all of a sudden I'm right. You know, it's like, it's the police. And I don't even think, I open up the door, I got a, you know, there's a bong sitting there. Open the door. I tell them what happened. I show them the pistol. I don't even think like gun laws, nothing. I'm so out of it, right? You shot at rats with a 22, and he goes, you're going to need something bigger than that. And he just takes the pistol and he leaves. Now, he was probably so happy he didn't have to do paperwork for a murder or anything. You know? He was just like, just give me the gun. I'm at you, knucklehead. Just give me the gun. And he just takes the pistol and leaves. And I go, okay.
That's one of the great stories that are in the book. The book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. Rich Scheidner is the author. Rich, can you hang on for a second?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, hold on a second. That's Rich Scheidner, and the book is called Kicking Through the Ashes. We've got a ton to talk about here. He's got a million stories, and he worked with so many people. And we're going to talk about what it was like to be there at the beginning of the comedy clubs and the comedy boom in the 70s and 80s. And it's all put down in this book. By the way, the introduction is by Bill Maher as well. Very entertaining introduction as well. It's a terrific book. We've got a link on our Facebook page where you can get it. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And we'll return. We got the news coming up here, and then we'll come back and talk more with Rich. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, here till 5 a.m. And my guest right now is comedian Rich Scheidner, who has written a terrific book called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 80s Comedy Boom. This guy was there when it all started, when the big 80s boom started, and he's written a terrific book about all the stories. And welcome back, Rich.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, man.
All right. Listen, I happen to be obsessed with watching. Do you get antenna TV where you are, Rich?
They do, but I can't get it in my house. It's like with Warner Cable out in L.A., I'm trying to figure out how to get it. I got to get one of my kids to try to figure it out for me.
Yeah, it's well, I have it, my morning routine when I get home from work, I get home from work usually doing the overnight shift here. I get home around 6 a.m., and I immediately watch the Johnny Carson rerun from the night before. It's my ritual. I watch it every time, every day. Now they've only shown one of your appearances so far in the time, mm-hmm. and it was a very interesting. I want to talk about, you know, your experience doing the Tonight Show because you've had great stories about it.
Sure.
But the one that they showed was a really strange episode, Rich. It was from '88, and entire show consisted of comedians who had gotten bumped.
Yeah.
Now, can you talk about that? And you did a great. Your set, by the way, killed. It was great. But what was that? Was a very strange. That was a very strange thing. With everybody was bumped. I thought that was kind of unique.
Yeah, it was. Bumped was such an inside thing back then. I mean, I wrote in a book about experience where I became like the bump champion for a while on the Merv Griffin show.
Right.
Back in the early '80s, I got bumped like 8 times in a row.
Yeah, for people who might not know what bumped is, you're scheduled to be on the show. It goes long, and you get bumped.
Right.
You don't get on.
Right. Because there's somebody who's, you know, higher up the food chain than you.
Right.
So they go, we'll just bring you back. And it happened from time to time, just get used to it. But for whatever reason, they bumped us a couple of times. Rita Rudnick got bumped, and I got bumped, and I forget who the third comic was.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Daryl Savat, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I can't remember.
Anyway, we got bumped. We got bumped, and they go, we're going to make a show. They're going to make a theme show out of it, you know, just to guide people who got bumped, so we guarantee you're going to do a panel, you know, you sit down and panel too, because I was also, again, I was at that level where if they had enough time, I got panel. If I didn't enough, you know, if Billy Crystal went a little long or whoever went a little long, I didn't get panel. So
right.
It was kind of a fun thing. It was fun.
Yeah, it was interesting. I'd never seen anything like it or since. Talk about your first appearance on The Tonight Show. You know, for people who, you know, listen to this show, I talk about The Tonight Show a lot. And, getting on The Tonight Show, how big a deal was that, Rich?
It was huge for a lot of reasons. You know, it's sort of for a lot of us comics, you know, who came from families who were like, "What are they doing? What are these people doing?" You know, us, like, we almost like ran off and joined the circus, you know, or a cult or something. So you surface on a Tonight Show to go, "Oh my God, he's in show business! There he is!" You know, because it's approval. You know, it's like your parents go, "Okay, that's I know Johnny Carson. So if Johnny Carson has one, the kid must be okay. So he's doing okay, right?"
Yeah.
So you got that. In the business, it was important. You got sort of like certified in the business. There were only three channels on all of TV, just three channels. Mm-hmm. Johnny Carson was the king. You know, he really was a jester situation. You had to make him laugh. If you didn't make him laugh, you didn't come back. You know, your career could stall. It could just die. So there was a lot of pressure on it. I broke out in shingles. My first time was 84.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what they were. All of a sudden, I've got these blisters that were very painful in my hip and my butt. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't sit down then. I was like, ow, what's going on? And I go to see a doctor like 2 days before I do tonight's show. And he goes, how old are you, man? I go, I'm like 28. He goes, well, you got whatever. You got shingles, man. You got an old man's thing. These things break out like when you're old. You're under a lot of stress. I go, well, between the cocaine, the alcohol, and doing a tonight show, yeah, I got a lot of stress right now. You know?
And
I think I should cut down the cigarettes. I should have cut down from two packs to a pack. Would that help? Would that get rid of the shingles? So he goes, that, you can't get rid of them right. He just put these pads, medicated pads on, you know, these medicated pads. And I walked out and did the first tonight show. He's, I didn't sit down for like 2 days. Medicated. It was bizarre.
This is a great story. Talk about how important it is to get the nod or the okay from Johnny.
Well, yeah, you got three reactions. You know, you look over, you finish, you kind of look over. It's almost like there's the judge, you know.
Right.
And if you did okay, you know, if you did great, he'd wave you over to the seat, you know, right. Wave you over, come on over to the panel. And
yeah.
There were a couple of people, like Stephen Wright, obviously had some blow away, unbelievable first thing. He goes right over to the panel. But, you know, if most of us got the circle finger, you know, the
right.
Four-finger thumb circle with the three fingers, hey, okay, you're okay, you
yeah.
did okay, you know,
right,
come
right.
back for another. But if you looked over and he wasn't looking at you and he was just tapping that pencil in his little cigarette box, you know, that's like a drum roll for your execution, man. That means you are not coming back.
Now,
man.
You decided to do a joke. You got that. You got the pencil drumming on one appearance because you decided to do a joke.
The second appearance, man, I'm hanging out with Sam Kennison. You know Sam. I'm just working the dark side, and you know, you get your material approved. So Jim McCauley, the town coordinator, he approved my material a couple weeks before you do it. So you're just practicing it over, and you got it approved. But like, Sam's like, it's not edgy enough. Like, oh, it's not edgy enough. I had this whole bit about because we'd gone see this group called Striper, which is a Christian heavy metal band.
Right.
And I came up with this whole bit based upon seeing them about Jesus talking to his agent. It was this whole bit about, geez, you got to get me out of the hills and valleys. I'm dying out there. You young kids, you don't want to pay your dues. You know, he said, book me in the temple. That's where the money is. You're very, very, very short memory, my friend. I had booked you last year and opened Messiah night at the temple. And you walk in, what's the first thing you do? You knock over the money changer's table. So I did this whole long routine of Jesus talking to his agent, right? And so I go, that's what I'll close with that, you know. I'll just knock off four jokes, a two-minute bit. I go, the next day I go to Tonight Show, and I tell Jim McCauley in the dressing room, like an hour before the show, he goes, you can't do that Jesus thing on Tonight Show. Get out of here, man. Forget it. I said, well, how about that? I got some other jokes that I wanted to. There was the first artificial heart recipient. I think his name was Barney Clark. I had a couple jokes about him, you know, and having the artificial heart and about defibrillator paddles, you know, saving a heart attack. I talked to McCauley and let me do those two as a closer. And man, I come off the stage. You know, the first time I come off is. You know, gives me the circle sign, and I come back to the curtain, and McCauley hands me a beer, and he's like, oh, fantastic. Everybody's tapping me on the back. Wait over here. Johnny wants to talk to me, because I come off after those all the tap jokes. McCauley grabs me, rushes me into the dressing room. Don't look at anybody. Just puts me in the dressing room. Don't move. Don't come out of here. Don't show your face. He just shuts the door. I wait about a half hour later, because I go, oh, we got big trouble. Big trouble. Johnny hated those heart attacks. You know, Johnny was smoking like four packs a day.
Yeah, oh yeah.
He was like deathly afraid of a heart attack. And he says, yeah, you gotta wait till Johnny leaves before you get out of here. They don't want to see you. I just sit there in the dressing room until everybody left, like the janitor's closing up. All right, you can leave now.
That's hilarious. Oh man. So.
And then, but yeah.
But you ended up you ended up coming back. And how many times did you do the Tonight?
Yeah.
How many times did you do?
I think it was like 14 with Johnny total, and I think 4 or 6 with Jay. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Now
I didn't tape them all. You know, I didn't tape them all back then. I just, you know, it was VCR. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't tape them.
Yeah, that's why you got to get Antenna TV, Rich.
Yeah. Yeah, now I got to get it on the TV.
You got
always
got
to get something. There's always something you got to get. You know what you got to get? You got to get on Facebook, man. You got to. Oh no, you got to get on MySpace.
MySpace. Yeah. Hey, by the way, I just wanted to mention this. The rerun that I watched yesterday morning when I got home from work, the stand up spot was Tom Parks, who you shared an audience with here in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. He's a great guy.
By the way, you have a really bad memory of that appearance at the Vic Theater. When you were
really had a bad memory. Yeah.
When you were taping your one night stand and you went up. I mean, you just boom, you blanked on stage. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about
that? Never happened. Never happened to me before. And I'm stone cold sober then. I mean, I had quit drinking and doing drugs 4 years before I did my HBO special.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I get out there and, you know, we practice things, a half hour. You know, the problem was I tried to be too precise. Like, instead of like just doing a half hour and like being loose, like I would do in a club and kind of have an idea where I wanted to go and just do material, try to build this like perfect half hour, constructed perfect, you know, and it's not the way I really worked.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think my mind just snapped. I got out there, it's the old Vic Theater, and I'm killing it. And I just look at the audience and go, I don't know what's next.
That's so terrible.
Nothing to say.
That's terrifying, man.
And they come, it's terrifying. And so, you know, the director, when she realized, you know, I think he really is stalled here, you know. So she walks out, and the whole audience looks at me, and they go, okay, look, we can just pick it up from here. And they go, yeah, but that one shot, you know, because just really have a lot of confidence in you.
Yeah.
I finished up whatever it was, 15 minutes to finish up. They go, all right, well, you got another show. I go, well, I think, and then I just kind of, I tossed that perfect thing, and I sort of just went with what I felt like doing, kind of.
Yeah.
And had an idea where it started, and then the second show was great. And they just used the second show.
They didn't even use anything from the first.
No. I told him, I said, no. They go, hey, we can cut in. I said, don't cut in anything. I don't want anything.
I was there that week.
I looked at the tape, and it really did look like kind of robot-y. It was like the first show. I mean, I wish I had a tape of it. I wish they'd give me the tape of it.
Yeah.
Because I looked kind of robot-y, you know. And then the robot just ran out of things to say.
That's so funny. I was actually, I went to one of those nights when they were at the Vic. And yeah. I saw Kathy Ladman and Taylor Negron. Taylor Negron was one of my favorites. You ever work with Taylor Negron?
Yeah, many times at the Improv in Los Angeles, many times.
Yeah, he was a funny man. He was a funny, funny guy. So, Rich, hang on, okay?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay. All right, there you go. It's Rich Scheidner, everybody, a great stand-up comedian who has so many great stories in this book. He was there during the entire 80s and 70s comedy boom. It's called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 80s Comedy Boom. It's a great, great book. It is very entertaining and really, really well-written. So we'll come back and talk more with Rich after we take a break. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And welcome back. We were talking with Rich Scheidner, who is a terrific comedian. I've been a fan for years, and he's written a great book called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. Rich, welcome back, man.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So, there are so many great stories in here. I don't even know where to begin. But I want to talk about some of the people that you've – one of my favorite stories in the book is your – your visit with Maury Amsterdam at a deli or at a restaurant. Can you please tell that story? Because it's so great.
Cantor's Deli is right around the corner from the Improv. It's on Fairfax in West Hollywood, and the Improv in Melrose. And so we go over there and have, you know, eat late at night after we'd finished doing stand-up. And one night we're sitting there, and we're, I don't know, a lot of these stories, you know, we'd had a couple drinks or whatever. And I see Maury Amsterdam sitting over there. And to me, he was always just Buddy from
Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke show.
Right.
So I go, you know, let's go. I would never do this, but, you know, I was a little buzzed. I go, let's go and say hello to Maury Amsterdam, man. Let's go. So we go over to Maury Amsterdam. He's sitting there with a couple of old guys with him. I mean, he was old. He was like 70-something. It was early 80s. And And we go over and introduce ourselves. Hey, Maury, we're a young comics. We work over here at the Improv. And he's like, yeah, that's great, you guys. I go over to see you at Bud's Place. It's fantastic. I like what you're doing. Yeah, we don't do like you guys do. We don't do like jokes and stuff. We like talk about the truth in our lives. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, that's great, guys. Tell me some of the things you talk about. Tell me what you talk about. You know? So I tell him one of my jokes, and he goes, yeah, that was done by Ricky O'Day in 1934, and he does it the way Ricky O'Day did it then, you know. And then every time we told him a joke, he'd say, yeah, that was done by Ricky Craig Jr. in 1932. You know, that was done by World War. Every joke we did, he told us how somebody did it like 40, 50 years ago. There wasn't one thing we had to, all the jokes are the same, you know. If you tell me one of your drug jokes, I could probably find a drunk joke that'll work the same thing. Because at the end of it, he's like, just knocks us out of the park. He goes, yeah, well, good luck doing whatever you're doing, those jokes, or whatever you call them, whatever you're doing. Fantastic. Good luck with them. He just kicks us right out of the room.
That's so funny.
Oh, that's so great. Now, let's talk about some of the guys that you worked with. I mean, that you've got some great stories in here. Like, you talk about the several times that you've seen Robin Williams just come in and destroy a room.
Oh. I mean, the first time I did it, and he was a great guy. And the first time, it was like 1979, I was emceeing at the Improv in New York City, and my brother was in the service, and he was coming home from basic training, and he just stopped in New York, and we were going to go down after, you know, and go visit my parents in South Jersey. And so he was in the back of the room in uniform, and this was before it was cool to be in the uniform. You know, so it was kind of like, you know, but everybody treated him great at the Improv. And Robin walks in. One of his deals where he was so hot, 1979, you can't even believe how hot he was. And it was a packed house, you know, at the Improv, and he just destroyed for 45 minutes. But everything he did, they laughed at. Every move he made, every, you know, wink, every hand gesture, everything. It was just, they were howling, destroyed. I mean, so, you know, I bring up the next act just working in a crater.
Oh,
I mean, the next couple acts just died behind him.
Yeah.
And I'm standing in the back because I'm the MC, and I got to, you know, because acts were bailing right and left. We probably went through five acts in 6 minutes.
Oh, man.
I can't do this.
How are you supposed to follow Robin Williams?
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't follow it. You couldn't follow it, man. It was just go up there and just take your beating, man. That's all. But Robin's standing next to me, and he said something. I'll never forget it. Standing next to me, and he just says, no one in particular just goes, I don't even know what's funny anymore. They're laughing at everything, so I don't know what's funny.
Mm.
I thought, wow, that was like an interesting, because I'd never had that experience that he had, where they're laughing at everything you do.
Yeah.
You lose your balance. His gyroscope was off. His comedic gyroscope was off. But we went out that night, because I just, in an 80s way, I saw him, you know, stand there for kind of confused for a second. I said, would you like a bump? And, you know, passing the cocaine, and he went off, and we became friends for that night, right?
Right.
We all went out. And we were drinking. Of course, we go to these bars, and the women recognize Rob and me. He's just surrounded by people and women. And my brother's this pimply-faced 19-year-old sitting down at the end, and nobody's talking to him. And then I notice this woman go down and start talking to him, being really nice to him, you know. And as we're leaving, I know, and Rob, did you send her down? He, like, winks at me. Of course he did. He sent a woman down to talk to the pimply-faced guy in uniform.
Oh,
and it was, like, the coolest thing. I thought it was a nice gesture. It was just a little,
That's funny.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. Great story. You also talk about how a memorable appearance that you witnessed Andy Kaufman during his wrestling, woman wrestling days. Can you tell?
Never seen anything like it. It's 1981 at the Improv. Again, I'm emceeing. Andy Kaufman walks into the Improv. There was a bar there. There was a bar, so he walks in the bar, and he had with him Fred Blassie and Captain Lou Albano. Now, I was a wrestling fan as a kid. I knew who these guys were. Nobody else in the bar knew who they were. So I go walking up to them. I forget it. Andy Kaufman. I go, it's Fred Blassie, you pencil neck geek. That was one of the things he used to say.
Yep.
And Captain Lou Albano, you know. And they're like, whoa, you recognize? I said, man, yeah, that's great. So then I go back to the bar, and I'm just sitting there, and they must have told Andy Kaufman that I went up to him, and he walks up to me and says, you know about wrestling? I go, oh, my God. You know, I used to wrestle in college and high school, but, professional wrestling. I love it. He goes, I'm going to do a professional wrestling thing tonight, and I'm going to challenge the women. And I need someone who will manage the women. You know, you want to be a professional wrestling manager tonight? I said, fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't know what he's going to do, but I said, yeah. He said, you know, I'll stage push you. I'll push you around and yell at each other. I said, yeah, I know the game. So I bring him on. You know, everybody's excited. It's Andy Kaufman. The audience goes crazy, goes up. They're all laughing and waiting. And he's got these little sweatpants on, a sweat T-shirt, and he starts strutting around this little stage, you know, the improv. And he goes, "I love women." And the whole audience goes, "Yay." He goes, "No, I mean, I love them." He goes, "Yeah, you know what I like them best? I love women best when they're cooking for me. They're cooking. That's where they should be, in the kitchen, cooking for me. Men, they should cook for men. They should clean the house and cook for men." And the audience starts turning away, man. And, you know, the women start rumbling, man. It's like 1979, man.
Yeah.
They're starting to rumble. And then the guys are like, "Hey, don't mess this thing up for us, Andy." They start booing, too, like everybody's booing it. And he keeps going. He goes, "No woman's equal to a man." And he pulls out like five $100 bills, and he goes, "I'll bet $500 right. If any woman can pin me, they can have the $500. But no woman can take a man. I'm a man." He's like, he's got those bad bodies, like doing muscle poses. But they're booing him. They're like, they're literally, they turn from like screaming and cheering to come on stage to booing him in 2 minutes. He turned them around,
yeah.
And he goes, "We need somebody to come up here and manage the women." So I go up there, and we start doing that thing. He's like, "Oh, you're going to be one of those guys that's going to help the women out." And we start screaming at each other, and he's pushing me, I'm pushing back, you know. And then a woman comes up, and he finally picks one out. First, he's dismissing them all, not good-looking enough. I mean, they hated him so much. He goes, "Yeah, you're not pretty enough. You're not pretty enough." So finally one comes up, and she is fired up, man. I mean, I saw it in her eyes. She was like, you know, "I'm going to kill this guy."
Yeah.
She goes, "What do I do?" You know, she takes off her high heels. "What do I do?" I go, "Look, man, just lift up his leg." I kind of knew he was going to go down, right? It's a little tiny stage.
Yeah.
And so they lock up, and she just reaches down, picks up his leg, and he flops on his back. I mean, it's just so obvious. He just flops his back. She falls on top of him. I get out of there, do the quick pin. Bam, bam, bam. She jumps up. The place goes crazy. They're cheering her like she won the Olympics. She's cheering. And Andy jumps up behind us. I didn't even really notice first. And he grabs the $500 bills off. It's like Snidely Whiplash from a cartoon.
Yeah.
He waves the $500 in the air. And he kicks open the side door and he runs out. And like, he steals the money that's supposed to be hers. And Lou, I didn't notice it, but Lou Albano and Freddie Glassy are already out in the limo right outside the door. And Andy Kaufman jumps in the limo, and half the room tries to follow him out the door. It's like a Three Stooges thing. We're all jammed in the doorway. Tables are flying. People are screaming. Again, this was like the opposite of Robin. This was like the audience was so angry and upset. Nobody could get a laugh for a couple acts.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great.
I've never seen him. They didn't even realize what he did to him. They never realized that he'd taken the comedy, that they turned him into a professional wrestling crowd. He didn't even realize what happened.
God, that is such a great story. Rich, can you hang on for a second?
Sure, man.
Okay, hold on. Rich Scheidner is with us, and we're gonna take a quick break for the news. The book is called Kicking Through the Ashes. Rich Scheidner has written it, and as great as he tells these stories that you hear, they're written beautifully in the book as well. It's a great book, and I highly recommend it. We're going to take a quick break for the news, and then we'll come back with more Rich Scheidner here on 720 WGN. Morning. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Friday morning. Fly Jams Friday will be coming up a little bit later on. We've got Straight Out of Context, Nick D. Show Spies, You Big Dummy, all coming up right here on the show. And I'm having such a great time talking to my current guest here, Rich Scheidner, who is the author of Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. A great, great book that I recommend everybody read, and a great introduction by Bill Maher, and we're hanging out with Rich. Rich, thanks for hanging with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, Nick, my pleasure. Listen, before we continue, I just want to offer you something. I mean, I really believe you love the book, and I want to do something more for you. I have about 40 stories that didn't get in the book that I was kind of like posting some of them on Facebook and all.
Yeah.
And if you get hold of the publicist, Jeff, and give me an email or something, I'll send them to you.
Oh, tomorrow. Thank you, man. I already can't wait to read them.
One of them's about smoking pot in the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., and some funny stories I think you'd like.
That's great, man. That's great. Well, we were talking about how, you know, people had to follow Robin Williams and then follow this insanity of Andy Kaufman. You go in the book about the importance of that, like and how the feature player, the opener, the feature player, and the headliner, that thing suddenly formed, and it was important.
Yeah.
And
It was just we first went out. You'd go out. They didn't have any kind of set. Like those first gigs that they were, Jerry Stanley was this guy booking these gigs in New Jersey, and they'd send four comics out. then it's like they kind of figured they want to do an hour and a half show, so then three comics in each one would do a half hour. And then, you know, it's natural selection. At some point, the three comics have decided among themselves, like, you're the strongest. I don't want to follow you. You close the show, and I'll go first. And this one's a little, you know, everybody's sort of naturally working it out. And then, yeah, it was just an evolution. Those three-act shows that we developed in America here, you know, the opener doing, like, you know, whatever it was, 15, 20, then 20, 25 in the middle, and then the headliner doing 45 or an hour. It just sort of happened.
Yeah, and you were an MC for a while. Well, you've done everything, but what was it like being an MC? Yeah. There was a challenge to that, correct?
Yeah, it's an art form. You know, you're host of the show, and you got to keep the show moving. So when you're in the showcase clubs in New York when you're doing it, you know, say Richard Belzer, the guys at Bill Maher, Richard Belzer, those comics at Catch a Rising Star, that club, they had complete control. They could go on as long as they wanted and bring an act up. But when you're at the Improv or the Comic Strip, the other two clubs, you know, your job was to keep the show moving. So if somebody died, you want to get them that bad taste out and go up and be funny for a little bit and get it rolling again and bring the next act up. But if somebody was killing and you just want to hand the ball off to the next act, you know, just get it on, just get it, keep it moving.
Yeah.
So. It was its own fun.
Yeah. I want you to tell another story. You got a phone call. This is such an amazing story. You got a phone call from Phyllis Diller. Can you tell that? Because it's such a great story, and she was so awesome. She was so funny and groundbreaking. You pay great tribute to her in the book. You do.
You know, I got bounced off the second Tonight Show. So in '86. I got a chance to come back. I got sober. I quit drinking and drugging, and everything changed around. And the Tonight Show booker said, I'm going to try to get back on, man. You're like a different guy. Your whole thing's different. And I got back, and I killed my third time. I got back on Tonight Show. I did great. And then, you know, people call you. I get this phone call, and it says, hey, it's Phyllis Diller. And I'm like, you know, somebody's goofing with me. Like, they're doing an impression of Phyllis Diller. You know, okay, that's good. Yeah, Phyllis Diller. She's like, no, it's Diller. I'm very interested. I can't do any impressions, but it's Phyllis Diller. And I just tell you, I just saw you. You're great. And we've just formed this, you know, she's invited me to her house and we just formed this friendship. And she was the one that was like, she said, we would talk about the history, because I started really getting into the history of stand-up comedy, and we would talk about the history of it. And of course, she knew so much of it. She was like the first female stand-up star, you know, that broke that, whatever you want to call it, man. She broke that ceiling or whatever. She became the first, you know, female stand-up star when there were really nobody around. In the 50s, and that just was, you know. So she's like, "You got to write the book." She's like, "Send me a card. You got to write the book of a history of stand up." And I got bogged down, and I was trying to do it, and it just felt like a textbook. And then I told her, "I'm going to write just about the 80s, my time." She goes, "Yeah, write about your time. Write about your time." But she had all these great things. I mean, she was, I don't know what, how. I don't want to get, you know. She was pretty earthy woman. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah,
she,
yeah.
You got to eat a lot of. Crap. She didn't use the word crap.
Right.
She used the other four-letter word for crap. But she goes, you got to, you know, in show business, you got to learn it. Eat crap and like it. When you like it, that's when you're doing okay. when you learn to like eating crap. Because you got to learn to do that. You got to learn to eat. That was like her thing. You got to learn. And she was also like good at like listen to what they're laughing at, you know, and do more of that. Like she called me up and I was doing a lot of stuff about men and women. And she's like, that's your goal, man. That's when you cook, when you do that. Listen to how hard they laugh. And she was right. So I just started dropping all the other kind of material about politics and stuff.
And didn't Rodney Dangerfield give you that advice, too? Just do what's funny.
Same advice from Rodney.
Yeah.
Same advice from Rodney.
Yeah.
You know, he goes, you got to tape yourself, man. You got to tape yourself. I don't like to tape myself. I hate the sound of my voice. Well, of course you hate the sound of your voice. You're a comedian. I sound like an idiot. Of course you sound like an idiot. What are you, a brain surgeon? No, you're a comedian. You're an idiot.
You know what I love? Goes, I love watching Rodney on The Tonight Show, because he killed every time he was on The Tonight Show. He killed. And then he would go over to the couch and kill again, because Johnny would just sit there and set him up.
You know, his panel, like a lot of times you go to panel, you're just going to tell stories, right? You're going to tell a story, you do your stand-up. Then you sit down, and Rodney would sit down and do the exact same thing he did standing up.
Exactly.
He'd do the same jokes.
Exactly.
He'd just do more jokes. He never just sat down and panel, like, got real about, you know, oh, really, Johnny, this is all an act, you know?
Yeah.
No, he'd sit down, he pounded so hard, man. His jokes were so hard.
Yeah, unbelievable. One of the greatest. Yeah. And it's great. Yeah. I mean, you know, getting advice from somebody like Phyllis Diller and somebody like Rodney Dangerfield, that's got to feel great.
Yeah, it does, man. I mean, you remember that stuff. I mean, people are like, how do you remember the stuff? And I go, how could you forget that stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, Rodney Dangerfield, one of his lines, he goes, you got to listen to the audience, man. They'll tell you it's funny because I'm telling you, man. Individually, they may be orangutans, but as a group, they're genius. how do you forget that? If you're in this business, I mean, maybe if you're not in this business, you don't remember. But to me, it's like, I can't forget that.
Yeah. Oh, so great. Let's talk a little bit about heckling, which I want to lead to one of the stories that's right at the end of the book. how do you? I mean, I've read the book, so I know how you feel. But tell everybody how you feel about hecklers.
I don't. See, I don't think every heckler's out there to kill the show. I think a lot of times they heckle just to see if you're there that night. If you're are you on remote control, is this the same thing you do every night, same way? Or you really loose and you're really here right now. They just challenge you. They just want to justify the fact that you're steering this ship. That's all they want to do.
Right.
And once you show them you're in control and you can handle it, you can go off, then they back off. There's very few times when they're really out there to try to kill the show. So I love hecklers. I had fun with them. I had fun. I turned their stuff into bits. I got bits out of hecklers.
Yeah, I love the fact that that's the way you look at it. What a lot of people don't realize is and you talk about this in the book, that there are standard replies that you use for hecklers, but it looks like it's coming off the top of your head.
Yes, stock replies. But
right.
I never liked to use them. I wanted to create my own. And plus, the hecklers don't know. They can't win. You got the lights pointing at you. You got the microphone. You're louder. Right? You're elevated. You're on the stage. Plus, beyond all that, the audience wants you to win. As long as you don't lose your temper, you can fake like you're angry. You can be mock frustrated. But as long as you don't really get angry, the audience wants you to win. If the heckler wins, what happens? The heckler doesn't go up there and do the rest of the show.
Right. Right. That's true. It's true. You know, I did stand up for about a year and a half at Zany's. Yes, Zany's here.
Great club. Great club.
Yeah. Bert Haas. I just came in. I was looking to make a couple of extra bucks. And I was like, hey, do you need somebody to like intro or, you know, to come in and, you know, like MC or something? And he's like, yeah, come on in. And you can do the last Wednesday of each month. So I was like, okay. And I had never done stand-up before. I did theater and, you know, comedy and stuff like that in plays, but I've never done stand-up. And so I walk in and I go, okay, Bert, I'm doing, like, intros, right? And he's like, nah, why don't you just do 10? And I was like, what? And he goes, just go up there and do 10 minutes. And I'm like, are you out of your mind?
And, just do 10.
Yeah, just go up and do 10. I'm like, well, are you kidding me? So I got up there
I haven't done one yet.
No, exactly.
You've just got out of a coma. Go run a marathon. You can't imagine.
But the thing is, like, I've had this radio show for a long time, and I have, you know, I've done some, you know, some rants on the air, and I tell a bunch of stories. So I just kind of took the stuff that would kill here on the radio show, and I did it on stage, and, you know, swore a little more. And I did really well. And so for about a year and a half, I was doing it. It was a lot of fun. And I never had a heckler, but I always got nervous when I got up there because I wouldn't know how to handle a heckler. And so that's why I wanted to ask you about the heckler. Now, the heckler late in the book, Rich, that the guy that was, you know, there was tell the story about how this heckler, actually you and him were killing. Like he was setting you up, and it was, and then you found out. Yeah, tell.
I was in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'd gone through 5 TV pilots. I was back out on the road, and I was really like, what am I doing back? It was like 90, 92, 93, and I didn't get that brass ring. And so I'm in this club. It's a new club. It's down in Charleston, South Carolina, this sports bar. They got a nice room upstairs. And this guy's coming in heckling, but he's great, man. He's great. He's setting me up. I'm getting laughs. He's getting laughs. Then he'd back off when I saw me do a run of material. He would not heckle. I'd do a run of material. Then we had a rhythm going. I finished doing a run. I'd go take a drink of the water. I'd look out, man. He'd come back. We'd play for a while. It was like one of the best shows I ever had. I come off the stage, and the club manager comes over. He goes, that was unbelievable, man. Like, you know, I got 2 hours of that. I said, oh, look, that heckler was – he made the show, man. That heckler. He goes, you know who that guy was? And no, he goes, it's Sean Penn. I go, what? Sean Penn? First of all, you don't expect Sean Penn to be in a comedy club anywhere. But in Charleston, South Carolina, what's Sean Penn doing down here? I go, are you kidding me? He goes, no, he wants to hang out with you. Really? Yeah, he wants to hang out. So – what happened was I didn't really think about it, but there was a hockey rink across the street, this minor league hockey rink, and the Eagles were on tour, and they were doing this the Hell Freezes Over tour, but it was the second leg of the tour, and Sean Penn had go over there to party with them, but the second leg was a rehab tour, You know, the first leg was like, you know, backstage was cocaine and right. women, and, right. And now it was backstage was sushi and juice bar, you know? Right. It was so Sean's like, he ain't hanging for that. So he came across the street, forget that, and came to this comedy club he found. So we're hanging out, man. Now, I'm straight. I'm just drinking Diet Coke. You know, we're hanging out all night long, 5 in the morning. I can't hang anymore, man. I'm done. I got to go. We're laughing, telling stories. He's telling stories. I'm telling stories. We're entertaining a bunch of people back and partying in this manager's office. It's the end of the night. I'm getting ready to leave. He goes, hey, before you go, Sean Penn's telling me, I got to tell you something, man. So he pulls me aside. I think he's going to, like, say, listen, man, you got to call my agent. We got to do a movie together, man. You and I, man. We got to do a thing. He goes, look at me. I got to look at me. He goes, you got to move to Los Angeles. I walk back. I'm going to stop at, like, the Waffle House to get some eggs at 5 in the morning. I'm walking back. I'm going, I've lived in Los Angeles for 10 years. I thought he knew who I was. Right. He didn't know who I was. He thought I was just a funny guy he met in South Carolina. Right, because that's a funny guy in South Carolina. He didn't know who I was. I thought he knew who I was.
That is so funny.
That's when I realized he stumbled into there from the Hell Freezes Over tour.
Right.
And then it's like, I go, I'm not making a dent in this business, man.
You just thought you were some local South Carolina guy. That is so, so funny. Yeah. Listen, Rich, I can't thank you enough, man, for being on the show. I've been a fan of yours for many years, and I adore this book, and it's been a blast talking to you.
Oh, man, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Nick. Thank you so much, man.
All right. So the book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 80s Comedy Boom, and it's great. Rich Scheidner. Don't look up the spelling. You won't be able to figure it out. But Rich, it was a real pleasure, man. Have a great morning, okay?
Mine too. Thank you, bro.
Take care, man. There you go. God. Rich Scheidner, man. The book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 80s Comedy Boom. And that's just a sampling of some of the great stories. There are tons more. We barely scratched the surface on this thing. It's a terrifically entertaining book. So there you go.